Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano, who is in Charlottesville, Virginia. How are things in Charlottesville, Frank?
Things in Charlottesville are great. Thank you, David. It's a little bit cold, as the lady in the office next to me said this morning. Look, I know it's January, but this isn't 18 degrees Fahrenheit yesterday, and which is minus 8 Celsius, which is pretty cold for this part of the world.
Ah, well, Central Virginia doesn't always handle cold weather all that well. And it's also, for those who are keeping track, this is our two-year anniversary. So happy anniversary, Frank. We've been recording this
show. Oh, happy anniversary, David. I didn't get you anything.
No, I didn't get you anything either. I guess we're at that stage in our relationship where we don't obsess over material goods.
No, ours is a deeper love, David.
And thank you, by the way, to all of our listeners who have stuck with us for 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yes. You're the ones who deserve the presents for your patience and all kinds of things. So what we thought we would do today with the episode is actually sort of deconstruct a recent event, which I think has really deep historical reverberations. And the event I'm talking about is a confrontation, maybe that's the right word, that happened a couple of days ago on January the 18th, on Saturday, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., in which a Native American activist and Vietnam veteran, Nathan Phillips, came face-to-face with a group of students from Covington Catholic High School from Kentucky. And this was a confrontation that has been in the news. We want to sort of talk about the incident itself, but I think what we want to mostly do is try to put this into some kind of historical context, because I think part of what the reason why it's reverberating so much is not only because it touches on this particular political moment, but because I think there's ways in which this incident calls to memory all kinds of other similar historical images.
Yeah, I mean, the images that were often circulated on social media over the past few days were of, the desegregation of Little Rock Central High School and the white students who were shouting at the black students, or some of the lunch counter protests in the late 50s and early 60s. And this was being presented, or has been presented, as akin to that kind of iconic moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think the visual of it seemed very similar, especially that many people commented on the high school students' facial expression and the ways in which it seemed to convey a people read a number of different things into it, but seemed to evoke these kinds of photos. Both of the people sort of yelling at civil rights protesters, but also at the people who sort of smirking in the background. There's a particular photo I'm thinking of, probably the same one you are, Frank, of the lunch counter protest, where people are pouring drinks on the protesters' heads, and there's people sort of milling in the background. Lots of people were sort of drawing those kinds of comparisons.
That's right. And the iconic image that seems to have emerged from the incident on Saturday was of a student. I know he's named himself and issued a PR statement, but we probably shouldn't name him just because he is under 18. I mean, his name's in the public sphere, so I suppose it doesn't matter. But anyway, that one of the students in particular, I mean, there was a large group of students, but the iconic image is of this one young male student confronting Mr. Phillips. And, well, confronting is a debate about whether he confronted him or not, but standing in front of Mr. Phillips with a kind of smirk on his face while Phillips played the drum and chanted a prayer. And so there's a kind of – that seems to be the real kind of takeaway, visual takeaway from this that's prompted all kinds of discussion, including ours.
So one of the things I think that's striking about this event is simply the location where it happened, at the Lincoln Memorial. I think that's part of why this event has been so galvanizing in some ways, because it's a monument to national unity built in the 1920s, designed to sort of signal national reconciliation. And of course, we're at a moment right now politically where we are very divided politically It's a monument also that's taken on sort of other meanings over time. It's obviously the site of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and this is happening during the Martin Luther King weekend. And so I think that sort of adds a level of historical meaning to this whole event. It's also a site where lots of anti-war protests took place during the Vietnam War, and of course Nathan Phillips is a Vietnam veteran, so that sort of adds a layer of meaning to this particular site. You know, the fact that we've got this happening as a consequence really of a convergence of a number of different rallies that are happening in D.C. at the same time, the two that sort of culminated in this unexpected meeting was the March for Life, which happens every January on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision from the early 1970s that legalized abortion, and the Indigenous Peoples March, which was supposed to sort of build on lots of the protests from the Dakota Access pipeline movement. And so, you know, it's bringing together some very diverse groups of people in the nation's capital at a very particularly interesting location.
Yeah, I mean, if there is, there's kind of, if America, indeed, the United States does have a civic religion, which I think it does in the forms in that our patriotic displays often take on quasi-religious meanings, then the Lincoln Memorial is pretty close to sacred space within that civic religion of the United States. It's not just another space.
Yeah, and it's a sacred in multiple different ways, right? People visit it for Lincoln. People visit it for Martin Luther King Jr. People visit it for other reasons. And so it has this sort of multiplicity of historical meanings placed upon it. And, you know, there's some more recent historical events, I think, which sort of tie into this. Obviously, the pictures we see of the young men, they are almost all wearing MAGA hats or shirts or paraphernalia of different kinds. You know, so this has become not only sort of a march against abortion rights that they were taking part of, but it's sort of tied in with this particular political moment. President Trump has, of course, made a number of comments about Elizabeth Warren, in which he's invoking Native American history because of Elizabeth Warren's claim from a long time ago that she had some Cherokee ancestry, calling her Pocahontas for the past several years as a derogatory term, which is offensive on multiple levels. Including a comment a couple weeks ago, or less than a couple weeks ago, a week ago, in which he evoked the massacre at Wounded Knee and saying that maybe Elizabeth Warren should have made her announcement that she was running for president at Wounded Knee, which is offensive on all other kinds of levels. What historical sort of things came out to you, Frank, as you were watching all of this unfold on Saturday and Sunday?
There are a couple things, David. The civil rights aspect of it and the resonances with some of the protests and counter-protests during that time period in the late 50s and 60s, which we've already mentioned in passing. I mean, you've done a good job of linking this incident to the longer history of Native Americans, and of course, it resonated there. I mean, the image of a kind of young white teenage male smirking, and I think smirking he was doing, in the face of an elderly Native American military veteran was very, very powerful indeed. One of the things that interested me, though, in the way it was more immediately what it said about the our political culture and recent political history, which is this incident became the subject of rather intense debate over the weekend about just what happened. And so we moved quickly from the incident itself, which was there was a brief video of, to a widely shared set of comments by Mr. Phillips explaining, you know, his giving his perspective on what happened, to a kind of counter-narrative that quickly emerged on Sunday. And then there were sort of Zapruder film-like analyses by people all over social media to contest the narrative and to debate what happened and whether Mr. Phillips was the aggressor and the young student who was stood opposite him was the victim. And so on. And there have been competing narratives and apologies from prominent people on social media, prominent journalists in particular. Hmm. And so I think there's been a more immediate resonance to recent political history, where we have incidents in which people can't even agree on the basic facts as to what happened. And that seems to be where we are at the moment. If you go look at the hashtag Covington Catholic, which is the school that these boys came from or attend, you'll see that there are widely divergent interpretations, with some people on the right calling the boys kind of calling them victims and saying President Trump, who tweeted about this yesterday, should have them to the White House, and others seeing them as the face of bigotry in the United States. I mean, and we can't even agree on what happened.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's sort of a Rashomon-like narrative at the moment, in which, depending, people are looking at the same sources even and coming to very different conclusions about who the protagonist is, who the antagonist, and who's responsible for different things and how we should interpret. Is it a smirk? Is it an innocent smile? Who is behaving aggressively? The narrative became a slightly more complex after the initial video just showed the confrontation, if that's the right word. I'm still trying to figure out whether that is the right word, between Nathan Phillips and the student. Became more complex when we got longer videos, and then we have this introduction of the Black Hebrew Israelite group, which appears to have a very small number of protesters that happened before Mr. Phillips arrived. That seems to have, they've been some tension between the Black Hebrew Israelites and the Covington Catholic High School students. That seems to have preceded this the event that's gotten all the attention. So it's got, the story's gotten more complex as it's unfolded.
And there have been subsequent videos. So there was a video late last night, which you may have seen. It's very, very short, by a woman, a young woman, and her friend, and they shared video of themselves being basically verbally abused by a group of young boys they claimed were from Covington Catholic. That this had happened prior to the incident that garnered all the attention. So it's a very, very fluid situation, a very confusing situation, and clearly people are believing, people are interpreting these events and interpreting these images depending on their political perspective.
I think that's right.
I think that probably includes us.
No, I'm sure it includes us. I think we're not, even though as historians you try to be objective about these things, especially for contemporary events, it's very hard to sort of disentangle our own biases and our own sort of political worldview from the way we see these events. I think when we see Nathan Phillips behaving in a very stoic way, and stoic again, I'm embedding an interpretation there with my choice of words, that harks back to all kinds of imagery we have of Native American protests in the 1960s, images going back from the 19th century of Native peoples, images of Sitting Bull and all other kinds of things that it seemed to evoke, at least in me. That's the kinds of imagery that came to the fore.
One of the things that happened, David, was that's happened over the past several days is we've learned, and I'm kind of using air quotes here again, I don't know whether we've learned or not. We've learned a lot about Covington Catholic High School, and there's been a lot on social media about students in blackface at basketball games and incidents of students using the white power sign or some students. The school is 98% white. The faculty, I believe, is all white.
Yes.
It's a fee-paying school. It's a private school. The students are generally, it seems, from affluent backgrounds. So there's been a kind of series of facts introduced, I guess, and again, maybe I should use that term advisedly, into this debate. But and we've seen these images, including images of a former student who's been convicted of rape. How do you feel about all that?
Wow, I have lots of feelings about all that. Some listeners may know that I attended private schools for most of my education, and taught for a while at a private institution, a private religious institution for that matter. And so there was elements of the narrative sort of unfolded on Saturday that seemed very, very familiar to me. The facial expression, which some people have characterized as a smirk, and I'm going to characterize as a smirk because that's what it looked like to me, that seemed very familiar to me as a sort of a signifier of certain kinds of white male privilege that I had seen many times before. One of the things that people haven't, mentioned about this incident or trying to think about this is the ways in which it reflects this growing power of private education or of alternatives to public education, starting in the mid-20th century. So Covington Catholic High School was founded in 1925, but the school doubled in size in the mid-1950s. And you may say, well, why did the school double in size in the mid-1950s?
Why did the school double in size in the mid-1950s,
well,
David?
I think the obvious answer is that Brown versus Board of Education and forced desegregation of public schools prompted lots of white Southerners of a variety of different, religious backgrounds and political persuasions and all kinds of things to pull their kids out of public schools.
Not just Southerners, it should be said,
because
there was a boom in parochial schools in the North as well.
To be sure, and it coincided with, thinking about from your part of the country, with busing and other kinds of efforts to integrate public schools more fully, even if the schools hadn't been segregated through law, they've been segregated through geography, and so there have been all kinds of efforts to desegregate, the Boston area schools, for instance, but, and lots of parents responded by putting, lots of white parents responded by putting their kids into private schools, and a lot of these are, had a religious affiliation. The school where I taught in Florida for 4 years was founded in the mid-1960s. And, the school, if you ask the people who are at the school, oh, no, we're not a segregation academy. That has nothing to do with it. But it's in a city that's half black, and it's a school that historically has been 95% white, since its inception. Even if it wasn't designed as a segregation academy, that seemed to be the motivation, at least, of some of the parents who chose to send their kids there. I'm not sure I knew that when the school hired me, but I'm not. But I think that's part and parcel of private education. The other thing that's been happening, I think, with the history with private education in recent decades is not only people are going to school because of the aftermath or response to integration, mass resistance, and what have you. But I think there's also a sort of an ideological and religious motivation for sending kids to private schools, that they will get a different kind of education that is appearing in public schools. And there's debates over sex education that drive kids into private schools. There's debates over evolution. There's debates, obviously, over abortion rights, political questions. I mean, the fact that all these kids are wearing MAGA gear. I mean, they must have really kind of cleared out the MAGA gear shop as they were in the march, if they didn't bring it with them. That kind of political uniformity, I think, is an artifact really of a kind of a self-segregation into these private school enclaves, especially these conservative private school enclaves. So there isn't really a diversity of opinion or a diversity of experience at any of these schools.
We learned during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, for example, because Georgetown Prep, another elite Catholic private school, which produced Judge Kavanaugh, or now Justice Kavanaugh, they received a lot of attention during those hearings back before Christmas. And, it was a pretty unflattering picture of the school that emerged, during the 1980s. And so to some extent, and a lot of people have drawn the line between the kids at Covington Catholic today and Brett Kavanaugh and his school experience at a similarly elite private Catholic institution. Is that a fair connection to draw in your view?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's a through line, a connection there between, and I again say this having been deeply involved in many of these schools, both as a student and as a teacher, they do create kind of a bubble, and I think Brett Kavanaugh was in a particular kind of bubble in Georgetown Prep, and I think the young men from Covington Catholic are in a similar kind of bubble where they don't interact very much with people of different experiences than they'd have, different sort of socioeconomic backgrounds, different racial backgrounds. Obviously, Covington Catholic is an all-male school. I think Georgetown Prep is also an all-male school. That creates a certain kind of, social dynamic that in some ways is very limiting. There are also places that because of the fees that the people pay to go to these schools, do sort of mean that they're all from this very similar socioeconomic background, and they can't, they get a great deal out of these schools because they go on to become Supreme Court justices and whatnot. But it does mean that they go to those positions with a very limited worldview.
What should be done about this, if anything? A lot of outrage over this incident from both left and right at the moment.
Yes.
Outrage on the left comes from seeing these young men as basically bullies who and they've been accused of being racists. People on the right have claimed that they are unfair victims of bullying and cyberbullying by so-called social justice warriors who don't know them. And I think there's an important element to all of this, which is in most cases they are not adults in the eyes of the law. They're under the age of 18. I would assume because they're high school students, most of them are under 18. And so I think that's an area of this that hasn't received much attention, but perhaps should. We're discussing this. Should we be discussing this?
Well, I think we're discussing this because it does have these deep political reverberations to it. One thing that not many people have noticed, but I think is important, this wouldn't have happened if the shutdown hadn't been happening. Inasmuch because the National Park Service, who would have been on site to make, segregate these various groups of people, have all been furloughed.
No, I've been to the Lincoln. I mean, you've been to the Lincoln Memorial many times. I have. I mean, it's pretty. The steps to the Lincoln Memorial are pretty freewheeling.
Oh, to be sure. But I think if they saw a group of 200 young men, you know, surrounding a handful of Native Americans, they probably would have intervened. It probably wouldn't have gone on for nearly as long as it did, because it seemed like this incident took, you know, a fairly long time to unfold. I'm not entirely sure where the chaperones were, because that seemed like a...
That's been one of the things, and allegedly they were waiting for their bus, but their bus took a long time to arrive, too.
Okay. You know, I think the United States is at a deeply divided, you know, the political and religious divisions within the United States, are starting at, you know, I think one of the things the signal is that this starts at a very young age, and how we sort of learn to live as a society, you know, politically, in which we don't start from similar base principles is very difficult. One of the stories that came out in the week prior to this incident was a story about Karen Pence and the school where she's teaching. Karen Pence is the wife of the vice president, where she teaches at a private school in the D.C. area, a religious school that has very I'm not even sure what the right words are to describe it. Other than to say,
don't allow
their discriminatory policies
or staff.
Not only that, but it's about the beliefs of the students who are and parents who are there. You say you cannot, you know, believe in gay marriage and send your child there. So it's not even about sort of the identity of the people who go to the school and attend the school. There's a much sort of broader ideological litmus test that they have to go through to, you know, sign off on to go to this place. And there's obviously a religious freedom question here, and all of that. But it, you know, what does that say about the status of, you know, American democracy? That this is where the vice president's wife is teaching the sort of worldview that she brings and her husband brings to, you know, obviously enormously powerful positions.
At risk of a bad pun, because I shouldn't use religious language. I think that interpretation is too apocalyptic. In the sense that, look, we know Mike and Karen Pence are, you know, anti-gay.
Yeah.
And you know, they have a long, long track record where that's concerned. We know a lot about their religious beliefs. None of this is a surprise. The school itself is not illegal.
Oh, no, to be sure.
Let me finish. Karen Pence working is not illegal. And so I think, you know, this is just evidence that we have, and we have recourse to do something about it at the ballot box. I don't think it presages the end of the republic necessarily. It's clearly not a school that I would want to be affiliated with. I certainly wouldn't want anyone in my family affiliated with it. But we should, you know, it doesn't change the calculus of anything we know about the Pences, and I'm slightly perplexed about that story in the sense that it kind of confirms what we knew, but I don't think it changes anything.
Well, I think people there was a particular piece of paperwork from the school. I think that was people found quite. I mean, I think it's not surprising cause, like, given what we know about the Pences, but I think that particular document, I think people found pretty extreme, even by their standards. How does this all fit into the history of religious schools? I mean, private schools are one thing, and I think religious schools are similar but not necessarily the same. How does all this fit into the history of religious schools, in particular into Catholic schools, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, David, because – and you're right. We shouldn't necessarily – the issue of private schools is an interesting one, but religious schools are a subset of private schools. I mean, the history of religious education in America is long and interesting. Of course, in the colonial period, all schools were religious in the sense that the dominant culture among settlers was Protestant, and most educational institutions had some sort of religious foundation. Not all, In fact, I'm a few miles from the University of Virginia, which was created with an explicitly non-religious foundation. But, you know, most institutions of either lower or higher learning had some sort of religious affiliation during the colonial and early national period. It's with the arrival of large numbers of Catholic immigrants, beginning with the famine in Ireland in the 1840s and then continuing really to the present day, that changes the equation. So Protestants in America come to really value the separation of church and state and trying to keep religion out of schools once there are lots of Catholics in the country and they're worried about Catholics receiving state support. Mm-hmm. And so there's an amendment proposed by James G. Blaine in 1875 to explicitly prohibit religious schools from getting any state funding. That fails at the national level, but it's adopted by many, many states, or its tenets are adopted by many states. There are a series of Supreme Court decisions in the late 19th and early 20th centuries about the degree to which the state can support or should support religious schools. In the Everson decision in 1947, the Supreme Court ruled that it was okay for a community in New Jersey to provide some financial support for people who sent their children to parochial schools, that is Catholic schools. But in so doing, Justice Hugo Black, who wrote the majority decision, introduced the Jeffersonian term, the wall of separation between church and state. Basically, the court in the Everson decision said, well, this isn't really material support for religion. It's support for getting kids to school. So we're okay with that. However, there must be a firm separation of church and state. Black, interestingly, was from Alabama. He had been a member of the KKK. He was very anti-Catholic. And so part of his motivation in embracing the separation of church and state was to keep the state and to keep the Catholic Church out of the state as well as the state out of the Catholic Church. Hmm. So there's a long tradition there. What I find interesting, and I think you and I have discussed this in the past, is in terms of let me back up briefly. What emerged from all that was, of course, a very interesting and almost unique to the United States kind of hierarchy or network of Catholic institutions, of educational institutions, both at the school level and all the way from primary school through to high school, and at the university level. So there's a network of Catholic universities in the United States that are among the foremost universities in the world, in part because Catholic education did not receive any state support, and Catholics were being discriminated against in the state system, and so they created a kind of parallel system within. So what is interesting, so that's the background, I guess, and what I think is interesting that in the past 40 years, the past 50 years really, where the division is, the cleavage in American life and the culture war is no longer between Catholics and Protestants. It's between Christians generally, Catholics and Protestants together, and if you will, non-Christians and non-believers. And so
some people might want to split it into being conservative Christians, which would be Catholics and evangelicals.
Yes, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Because there are liberal Christians, but yes,
there are. Sorry, that's an important qualifier. But in terms of this institutional support for education, it tends to be conservative Christians. You're right. Yeah. That's important. That's an important qualifier. But they've kind of come together. So these religious institutions like Covington Catholic High School and the school that Karen Pence works at probably feel they have more in common than their forefathers ever would have imagined, say, a century ago, where their coming together would have been unimaginable.
I think that's definitely right. I think, you know, abortion rights is the fight against abortion rights, I should say, is I think one of the sort of unifying factors in doing that. There are other obviously political issues, but I think that, you know, comes to the fore, especially last weekend.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, those boys were at the March for Life. That was their ostensible reason for going there. And they, you know, put on the paraphernalia of Trump supporters because they, you know, they were making an explicitly political statement.
What's been the Catholic Church's, and especially with education, relationship with Native Americans?
Well, it's complicated because, of course, the church – was implicated. We talked about Native American schools not too long ago, and Indian boarding schools intended to kind of get the Indian out of Indians, and so on. And the Catholic Church has been implicated in that movement, both in the United States and in Canada, and actually across the Americas, as part of this kind of civilizing mission, which I'm again using air quotes around. And so the church's history with Native Americans is mixed, unsurprisingly, like many large institutions. Having said that, to some extent, again, going as far back as the colonial period, there was a belief that the church was more tolerant and of Native American culture than many Protestant denominations were.
Sure, especially in Canada, that seems to have been the case.
That's right. You know, and then so there's a kind of stereotype about the Jesuit black robes or so on, you know, going out and learning native indigenous languages and trying to really understand indigenous culture as opposed to kind of suppress it, which was the kind of Protestant instinct. So there's an interesting contrast between New England and New France in the 17th century where that's concerned.
Although I guess you would paint a fairly different picture, I think, in New Spain.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. Although even in New Spain, well, it is different because now we're getting into church history here. It does depend on whether the denomination that goes out are Dominicans as opposed to Franciscans as opposed to Jesuits and so on. So there's a complicated kind of intra-church history there as well. But yeah, unsurprisingly, the Americas are vast and the Catholic Church is vast, so the history is a complicated one.
Okay. Well, I think we've sort of squeezed a lot out of this particular episode here. We've got religion, we've got education, we've got Native Americans, we've got Vietnam, we've got abortion rights, we've got MAGA, we got Abraham Lincoln here in the background.
Before we wrap up, though, can I ask you one question, David?
Yeah, you can ask me as many questions as you like.
This interests me in an age of kind of social media opprobrium. The young guy who the smirking guy, and I agree with you. I think he was smirking.
Okay.
And I think his behavior was pretty, and I think that of his classmates was objectionable in all kinds of ways. So I'm not here to defend him. But he is a kid. And this will follow him for the rest of his life, presumably. He will, unless he changes his name and changes his identity, you know, you will be able to Google him when he's applying for a job. And there was some talk about whether the university admissions prospects of these kids would be affected. And on one hand, I think, well, you know, you did what you did. You live with the consequences. On the other, he is a kid. And how long should he, you know, maybe he'll, when he's 25, he will completely regret what he did. How long should he pay?
Well, I should say a couple of things about that. One is, you know, there's this discourse that happens in which young white men are described as boys well after they're 18, and there are young men of color who are described as men when they are under the age of 18.
Often far under.
Exactly. So there's ways in which, you know, the culture as a whole tends to be more forgiving of missteps by young white men than they are of especially young privileged white men than they are of many other people. So, given the contemporary and historic violence that the young men of color have faced, I put this young man's future suffering in that context. One thing I've noticed about this generation of people, having some of them live with me, my kids, they're a generation that is very cognizant of sort of the permanence of the internet, the ways in which, these kinds of statements, things that people do when they are relatively young, sticks with them in a way that, you know, for those of us who are older than they are, you know, who are teenagers in a pre-internet world, you know, our teenage missteps are thankfully erased or at least, you know, mostly forgotten, unless you're Brett Kavanaugh, in which case people, you know, bring them up. But if, unless we're going under that kind of scrutiny, most of us have, you know, both grave mistakes and minor mistakes are, you know, forgotten. I think this generation is very aware that these things are permanent and are very careful about how they situate themselves online, or at least they're, many of them are more thoughtful about it than we may give them credit for. You know, I could see a couple things happening with this particular individual. I could see him on the one hand being, you know, vilified in 10, 15 years and having this, you know, hinder his progress. On the other hand, I could see him, given this sort of particular way in which celebrity and politics works right now, I could see this actually working to his advantage.
Have his own show on Fox.
You know, in which he is a valorized for, you know, being attacked by the left and therefore, you know, having a certain kind of celebrity status. So I could easily see that happening as well, just given the way these things sort of play out. What do you think?
I don't know. I think your point about race is really important, because we've seen lots of black children killed by the state, by or representatives of the state, and there not being any consequences. And that's a far graver problem than what this individual faces. On the other hand, you know, acting stupid when you're 17 is, I honestly don't know the answer to this question, mm-hmm. but it's something that interests me both as somebody who works with lots of young people and is the parent of young people. So I don't have an answer for it, frankly. I don't know.
I mean, there are degrees of stupid in, of acting when you're 17.
Again, I don't have a lot of time for this kid. I think, you know, his actions were pretty objectionable, but he did not. There are far worse things he could have done.
Yes. Oh, to be sure. All right. I think we're time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
Quickly, and this relates to what we've been discussing. The University of Notre Dame is covering its murals. There was a story about this. Notre Dame has a series of murals in its main administrative building depicting Columbus's arrival in the New World. And there have been a lot of objections to this. It ties to a lot of the things we've been discussing, Native Americans, the history of colonialism, and so on. And these have been objected to because they seem to celebrate Columbus, who's a problematic character, and colonialism. They were actually painted in the 1880s at a time when, of course, Catholics in the United States were facing a huge amount of prejudice, and they were intended to provide students at Notre Dame with examples of kind of important Catholics and Catholic success in history. So it's just an interest, and now Notre Dame has decided to cover these murals and to have a permanent exhibition explaining their context. They can't remove them because they're actually painted on the walls, well, as murals frequently are,
yes.
by definition.
Yes.
And there's been a little bit of backlash from the right on this and so on, but it's I find it an interesting story of how a university is dealing with its history.
Okay,
you, David.
Great. So I'm going to do three last drops because I can, and they'll be brief. So the first is I want to recommend a recent episode of the Planet Money podcast. This is one of these NPR podcasts. Planet Money does finance stuff. But their recent episode called The First Shutdown looks at the federal shutdown of 1879, immediately after Reconstruction. And it's a really good explanation about sort of how that shutdown happened. It features Heather Cox Richardson, who is a really extraordinary historian of the Republican Party, especially during the late 19th century. So I want to recommend people listen to that episode. The second thing I want to recommend, since this is our second anniversary show, our friends at Backstory just celebrated their 10th anniversary. So I want to say happy anniversary to the people at Backstory. Congratulations on 10 years. And finally, on the anniversary note, today is my 23rd wedding anniversary. My wife Ida doesn't actually listen to the podcast, but in case she ever does, happy anniversary, darling. Frank had to duck out just as we were finishing recording that episode, so the sign-off is just for me. Cheers, everybody. Thanks for listening.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.